ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
International law can be a tricky thing to enforce,
especially when a state has powerful friends.
How far have the ICC and ICJ cases against Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel progressed?
And what's going on behind the scenes?
Today on Global Roaming, a man who oversaw almost three decades worth of investigations
into states suspected of human rights violations.
I'm Latika Burke.
I'm Kylie Morris, and this is Global Roaming.
Kylie Morris, welcome back to Global Roaming. Where have you been?
I have been in Japan, along with half of Australia, I think. It is now officially the foreign destination du jour for most Australians.
I am so jealous of you, Kylie. Japan is a country that I think ruins wherever your home is, no matter how much you love it. When I first got back to London after Japan, I spent about 2 years in mourning, wishing for trains that came on time, nice clean footpaths. It's an absolute dream, Japan. Now, we have a very serious topic to discuss today, a topic that actually people may not have thought about for a couple of years because it's been some time since charges were announced by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, against Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's Prime Minister, and Yoav Gallant. Now, Kylie, this case has not really progressed anywhere. It's a complicated and tricky matter.
It is. I wonder how much of the reason for the falling away of our focus on these cases has been in part because we're not talking about Gaza as much as we were. I think there's a problem with that. But there is now so much focus on the Iran conflict, on what's going on in Lebanon, that there is less attention being paid to the situation facing Palestinians in Gaza. Of course, these arrest warrants against Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu were issued by the International Criminal Court. The allegations behind the ICC warrant identify specifically that both men were using starvation as a method of warfare, that they were intentionally directing attacks against the civilian population inside Gaza, also that they had committed crimes against humanity, including murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts. Now, you may remember at the time there was a flurry of very strongly worded responses, not only from Israel but also from the United States. Joe Biden called the charges outrageous. Benjamin Netanyahu said that this was an attempt by the court to deny Israel the basic right of self-defense. Nevertheless, those warrants are still in place, although Benjamin Netanyahu has been able to travel. He's traveled to the United States. He's traveled to Hungary, where he was welcomed by Orban. However, the places where he might be able to do that in the future, it seems, may be shrinking.
Yes, well, to update us on where this case is at, where it's headed, and also put it in the context of the diminishing role, perhaps, of multilateral institutions, is Kenneth Roth, an American attorney and human rights activist. Now, he was the federal prosecutor for New York and the Iran-Contra investigation. He spent nearly 30 years as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, which would carry out investigations into countries to uncover and expose human rights abuses. His book, Righting Wrongs, is about the innovations and strategies used to battle autocrats and oppressive governments. Here he is now.
Ken Roth, welcome to Global Roaming.
My pleasure to be with you.
it's important, I think, given what is going on in the Middle East at the moment, for us to dig down into what has happened to the cases against Israel, but also specifically the arrest warrant out for Yoav Gallant and also Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The ICC, so the International Criminal Court, has had that arrest warrant out since November 2024. Where is that case actually at the moment?
Well, I mean, technically, there's an outstanding arrest warrant. You know, if Netanyahu or Gallant were to travel to any member state of the International Criminal Court, that state would have an obligation to arrest him. And most have. Now, you know, Hungary under Viktor Orban was saying, oh, you know, Netanyahu, you can come here. I'm pulling out of the ICC. You know, interestingly, Peter Magyar, the incoming prime minister who just, you know, overwhelmingly beat Orban, has announced already, I'm going to stop Orban's withdrawal from the ICC. If Netanyahu wants to come to my inauguration, he's welcome, but I'm not going to let him leave. We're going to arrest him. You know, so the world is smaller for Netanyahu. You know, he can still travel to the United States because the U.S. is not a member. He could not go to Australia. You know, Australia would be obliged to arrest him. Now, it is worth maybe just taking a moment and saying, you know, how is it possible for the ICC to prosecute Netanyahu? Because Israel is not a member of the International Criminal Court. We fought vigorously to maintain the option that we ultimately prevailed on, which is that if a government joins the ICC, then any crime committed on its territory can be prosecuted, even if the perpetrator is the citizen of a government that has not joined the court. That's known as territorial jurisdiction. That's why, for example, the ICC has been able to charge Putin, even though Russia never joined the court, Ukraine has. And it's why they were able to charge Netanyahu and Gallant. Israel never joined the court, but Palestine did. And so that basic principle is why the court appropriately has jurisdiction over Netanyahu, why he's facing charges, and why if he went to any ICC member state, he'd be arrested.
But Ken, am I right in thinking that there are problems too that are facing the ICC prosecutor that have effectively slowed everything down beyond those logistical questions of membership?
Kylie, you're totally right. And this is completely frustrating. Karim Khan is the chief prosecutor. He has faced allegations by a senior staff member of sexual abuse. And because of those allegations, he has been on administrative leave for basically the last year. Now, you know, that was appropriate. This should be investigated. But the member states have proceeded painfully slowly. You know, it's not that complicated a case. There's a, you know, an alleged perpetrator, an alleged victim, two people. You know, it's not like this stuff happened with witnesses around. And so it shouldn't have been that complicated to resolve. But here we are a year later, and it's still being fought out. I think this is utterly irresponsible on the part of the member states. And, you know, without trying to judge, you know, whether Karim Khan should come or go, it should be resolved. Because during this period of administrative leave, there have been two deputies running things. They don't have the stature to make major decisions. And so there have been consequences for that. For example, you know, in Ukraine, Putin, he was charged with kidnapping Ukrainian children, but he has not yet been charged with any bombing. You know, for Russian military commanders have been, but not yet Putin, even though Putin's the commander-in-chief. You know, in Israel, Netanyahu and Gallant were charged with the starvation and deprivation strategy. Nobody's been charged for the bombing. Nobody's been charged for the settlements, which are blatant war crimes. They're violations of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits, you know, moving an occupier's population into occupied territory. Trump hasn't been charged for obstructing justice, which is what he has done by imposing sanctions on ICC prosecutors and judges for ruling against Israel. So there are big tasks that require a chief prosecutor, somebody of stature, and we don't have those cases moving forward because of this painfully slow process.
But doesn't it expose a fragility, if you like, about the court and the way that the court is working if one individual, so the situation that Karim Khan finds himself in, is able to effectively throw sand in the wheels of the entire process?
I mean, yes. I mean, you would hope that there'd be enough depth there. I actually think that, you know, from what I know of the deputies, if, you know, if one of them, say, were appointed the chief prosecutor, they would do just fine. But they're, you know, they don't have that title right now. And you have to recognize that, you know, to charge a Putin, to charge a Trump, to charge Netanyahu, these are big decisions that require somebody of stature and who feels that, you know, who acts as if they have the confidence of the international community behind them, which nobody else has right now. And so, you know, sadly, we are stuck with this personal matter involving Karim Khan that has stymied the court for a year.
Kenneth, do you think that the election of Donald Trump in between those charges being laid and where we find ourselves today has contributed at all to this period of stasis that the charges seem to be in? Trump has come out very strongly against the ICC, accused it of being political. And it certainly is a lot harder, isn't it, without the US on side or at least neutral to launch these sorts of cases?
Well, I mean, Latika, to put this in perspective, the U.S. always was against the court. You know, I mean, back when we won in Rome, where we got territorial jurisdiction accepted, we won that by a vote of 120-7. You know, the U.S. was utterly isolated. And so, you know, we showed that we were able to kind of build sufficient moral and political clout by bringing together, you know, law-abiding states like Australia. Without the superpowers, you know, without the United States, without Russia, without China, they were all against us. So it is possible to move forward. The U.S. attitude toward the court has changed over time. When it was first adopted, Clinton just kind of accepted it. He actually signed the treaty but didn't ratify it. When George W. Bush came in, he basically started attacking the court. He went around the world and, you know, forced governments to try to repudiate it. But even Bush started to soften on the court when it went after the genocide in Darfur, because that was perceived in the United States as targeting Christians. And Bush's base was Christian. And so he suddenly didn't veto a Security Council referral of Sudan to the ICC. Under Obama, he went a step further. He voted for referring Libya to the International Criminal Court. He cooperated with the court in places like Central African Republic and Eastern Congo. And then when the court charged Putin, even the Republicans embraced it. You know, Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, who is, you know, probably the leading international affairs spokesperson in the Senate, notoriously right-wing, he embraced the court. He said, "I've changed my mind. You know, they've charged Putin. This is great." He went to The Hague. He met with Karim Khan. Then when they charged Netanyahu, it all changed. Suddenly, they hate the court. They want to impose sanctions. So this is not a principled position. You know, would it be better to have the U.S. on board? Yes. Does the court need the U.S. to survive? No, it's hardly ever had the U.S. except for this brief period after it charged Putin.
So you see this as part of a natural seesawing in terms of U.S. support rather than a trajectory of overall decline in multilateral institutions, which we're observing right around the world.
First of all, with respect to the U.S., I mean, you know, as in Australia, I mean, esteem for Israel is plummeting. You know, and if you look at, I mean, I just saw a poll among Democratic voters in the United States, you know, huge, huge negatives for Israel. You know, this is just not what it used to be. But after a certain point, you know, people don't want to be supporting genocide. It's as simple as that. And so I think that, you know, a next administration could easily re-embrace the court. That's entirely possible. In terms of, you know, overall international institutions, it really is important to stress which ones. I mean, if you look at the UN Security Council, that is utterly stymied by the veto. But, you know, the UN General Assembly, the UN Human Rights Council, places where there is no veto, they have done a decent job on Ukraine, on Gaza. They've repeatedly condemned what's happened. They've, you know, launched investigations. They're present. You know, if I look at the Human Rights Council, which is where I'm most familiar, where I've done the most work, you know, we get things done at the Human Rights Council all the time, whether condemnations or launching investigations or creating mechanisms to preserve evidence for prosecution. This is a very viable forum. We don't win every single one, but we win a lot. So I would not say that multilateral institutions are in decline. I mean, it's true that Trump is, you know, flouting international law. He's committing acts of aggression in Venezuela and Iran. He, you know, is openly threatening to bomb Iranian power plants and bridges, you know, blatant war crimes. So, you know, yes, you've got a very visible person who is just ignoring international law. But if you look at the response of other governments, they're appalled. you know, there have been widespread...
But it's actually not just Trump, though, Ken. I mean, really interestingly in Australia, you've referenced Australia several times here, Penny Wong, who's a left-wing Labor foreign minister, recently justified Australia's initial support for Trump's war in Iran and Israel's war against Iran, saying that the UN had failed to deal with a nuclear arming Iran. I mean, that is hardly the condemnation of somebody like Trump just trashing international law. That's a left-wing Labor figure.
Well, look, I mean, Penny Wong is just wrong on that, I've got to say. I mean, first of all, this was not the UN's problem. I mean, the UN arms inspectors were in there until Trump ripped up Obama's nuclear deal. And that's when he basically killed those inspections. But, you know, if you look at, you know, first of all, Obama did stop the program toward developing a nuclear bomb. It was Trump who was going to do better than that. He's put the United States in a far worse position. In terms of, you know, the bombing of Iran, if you look at the UN Charter, it permits the use of military force against another state in only two circumstances. You know, one is with the approval of the UN Security Council, that obviously didn't happen. The other is if there's an actual or imminent armed attack, neither of which took place. If you look at what Trump said in his video message justifying the war, he said, oh, look at, you know, Iran poses a threat in the future. It might develop a nuclear bomb. That is a preventive war. That is not a justified war. If you can, you know, go to war just because you want to prevent some harm in the future, you're going to have wars left and right. The UN Charter was designed to preclude that. What Trump did was a blatant war of aggression. Penny Wong should know that.
People who oppose or are skeptical, I guess, of the court's reach and the court's purpose often use the language of, you know, this is a pick and mix court. It's a court that acts against those who are politically out of favour and not those who are deserved of attention. You know, why go after Israel and not go after Iran, for example? But it is important, I think, to note that when Karim Khan issued these arrest warrants for Gallant and for Netanyahu, there were also three Hamas figures who faced an arrest warrant from the court. Do you have any information about how those cases are proceeding?
Well, the Hamas figures are all dead, so they're not going forward. You know, they've been killed by Israel. So at this point, the only viable cases there are the ones against Netanyahu and Gallant. But, you know, to say that the ICC goes after only easy cases, I think it's just wrong. I mean, it was not easy to go after Netanyahu. They know that they were going to subject themselves to likely sanctions from Trump. You know, to go after Putin was not easy. You know, now, why did they not go after Iran? They actually sadly don't have jurisdiction in Iran because Iran has never joined the court. I'd like to see them do that because that would be one way to address, you know, not only Trump's bombing, but also, you know, the Iranians' summary execution of some 7,000 protesters. But it's precisely that risk to the Iranian regime that is precluding them from joining. You know, the other way would be for, you know, some future Democratic administration to allow the Security Council to refer Iran to the International Criminal Court. That's feasible, but we're not there yet, you know, not during the Trump administration.
Trump has sanctioned ICC officials, particularly looking at those who were involved in investigating the US or Israeli nationals. What's been the impact of those sanctions?
Most of the sanctions, and there have been subsequent ones since those initial rounds, were all about either a judge who voted for the arrest warrant or to uphold the arrest warrant for Netanyahu and Gallant, or for, you know, the prosecutors who were involved, Karim Khan and his two deputies. So it is, you know, just worth noting that this is obstruction of justice. The Rome Statute prohibits intimidating or threatening a court official because of their duties. That's exactly what Trump has done. So he could be charged with that crime. How has it affected the court? It's very difficult. They, you know, cannot use their credit cards. They can't take money out of the bank. You know, they are precluded from traveling to the United States. You can live without that. But, you know, to live in a modern world without having access to basic banking is difficult.
So how viable do you think these cases are going forward?
Oh, I think that they are completely viable. In fact, I think once we have a prosecutor back in place, we will see additional charges. We will certainly see charges for the settlements. I mean, that case was ready to go. I mean, Karim Khan really should have pulled the trigger on that a long time ago. I think we also will see charges most likely for the dropping of these huge 2,000-pound bombs in Palestinian neighborhoods. They basically can kill anybody within the radius of two football fields. They're utterly inappropriate. They're blatantly indiscriminate. They're clear war crimes. And I think that those will be the easiest bombing cases to be pursued. So I think we will see those. Now, you know, will Netanyahu find himself in The Hague? You know, it would take some Israeli government turning him over. But it is very hard to avoid that forever. You have to be basically president or prime minister for life. And I think, for example, to Slobodan Milosevic, the former Serbian president, who was sort of indifferent to being charged by, you know, a different international tribunal for war crimes in Bosnia. He thought he was fine. He's president of Serbia. He was going to get him. But he lost an election.
It took a long time, though, Ken.
More recently. Just to finish that story first, I mean, there's a new government. They wanted sanctions lifted. They sent him to The Hague. And he died on trial in The Hague. More recently, look at Duterte in the Philippines. Okay, Duterte, you know, was summarily executing drug suspects. He was appropriately charged for crimes against humanity by the ICC. He thought he had protected himself. He was term limited out. He couldn't stay on as president. He arranged for his daughter, Sara Duterte, to be vice president. You know, she'd be protected. But Sara Duterte had a falling out with the president, Marcos. And Marcos put Duterte, father, on the plane to The Hague, where he now is awaiting trial. So it is really hard to tell how these things go. It's not inconceivable that some future Israeli government to try to turn the page on this awful era to say, we don't represent genocide, we represent the rule of law, we want to redeem Israel's abysmal reputation, we're going to let Netanyahu defend himself. You know, if he claims that he's doing everything lawfully, why is he running away from The Hague? You know, I contrast Netanyahu's behavior with the former president of Kenya, Kenyatta, who was charged by the ICC as he was president, and he went to The Hague. He said, okay, I'll fight the charges. They let him go on bail because he showed up voluntarily, and ultimately the charges were dismissed. Now, I think the case against Netanyahu is much stronger, but if he really is so innocent as he claims, show up. You know, what's he running away from?
Ken, we'll no doubt have reason to talk again soon enough, but thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. Kylie, it really is the key question, isn't it? How viable are these charges and arrest warrants? And will we ever see Yoav Gallant or Benjamin Netanyahu in the dock in The Hague? I'm less convinced, but I do take the Milosevic analogy quite seriously because it did take a lot of time, but justice in the end was served.
Yeah, I mean, that felt well argued, I think. I mean, I was also fascinated by the problems within the court itself and the impact that that's having. There seems to be, I guess, a fair degree of confidence, certainly on the part of the court, in the way that these charges have been framed and the potential success of those were Gallant or Netanyahu ever to face the court. But the fact that there's been really very little movement against either of those men or in those cases because of problems within the court itself, because of the allegations against Karim Khan, but also because of the politics around membership of the court. And they feel to me, I suppose, symptomatic of weaknesses within the court in terms of its membership and how many countries subscribe to it and the way in which that means that someone who is the subject of an arrest warrant like Benjamin Netanyahu has options that mean he can evade arrest.
What did you make about his verdict on Penny Wong's judgment on multilateralism and specifically that example about the UN or international mechanisms having failed the world on Iran? I thought he was very strong, but you really can't deny that that's a left-wing and a very prominent left-wing figure saying that about the UN.
I mean, it's not unusual to hear that kind of criticism of the UN, particularly when it comes to Iran. And on the court itself, of course, as I raised with Ken, there has been a great deal of criticism over the court failing to identify others who are involved in violence genocidal violence and a preference instead being given to, I mean, this is the criticism, right? A preference being given to Israel and a targeting indeed of Benjamin Netanyahu. As Ken described, you know, there were Hamas officials who were also subject of warrants, but they have now all been killed. His argument for why Iran hasn't been targeted and the weakness in the court, again, it comes down to membership, right? Because Iran isn't a member state, then the court doesn't reach so far. So there are inherent problems here. But I also on the flip side to that, we have events like the election of Peter Magyar in Hungary and a shifting in the politics in Europe that mean that where Netanyahu might have felt enjoyed some kind of safe haven in Hungary under Orban, he's not going to face the same reception from Peter Magyar. And, of course, in terms of the broader politics of the EU, that's going to make a big difference potentially to the way in which the EU as a collective might choose to act toward Israel, because they won't have Orban blocking action as they have previously.
Yes, although the EU did meet today and under the auspices of the diplomatic arm of the European Commission, which is certainly not its most powerful bloc by any means, they couldn't agree, which is a very common problem when it comes to gathering so many member states on questions of foreign policy, which, of course, member states still hold competence for. But yes, it is certainly a change in the wind when it comes to Hungary's position on Israel.
I find these kinds of conversations are so difficult because, of course, international law is imperfect, and the politics and the community of nations are outside that law are also, you know, not of one mind with lots of competing agendas. But that doesn't mean that there is an irrelevance here. At its core, this is the only mechanism the world has agreed upon in order to manage the prospect of future genocides. And so I think it's important to remind ourselves of where these kinds of cases are at. Of course, as we're very aware on this show, you know, the speed of international affairs is so great at the moment that we're already talking about another set of conflicts, you know, in Lebanon, in Iran, in the Gulf states. So it's easy for your focus to be pulled so quickly away from perhaps things that you should be keeping a closer eye on. So it was good to hear, I think, an update from Ken this week. No doubt you will have opinions about the conversation today, and we'd really like to hear from you. We've had a number of emails recently about the UN. I mean, moments like this are moments when I guess people go back to that body and want to know what its impacts will be. Christine wrote to us to say that no one appears to discuss the role that the UN has played in feeding wars. Her allegations are that Gaza has relied heavily on aid for many decades, and yet the countries giving this aid didn't provide checks and balances. Alan has written in to say the veto power of the five countries selected to represent all countries is after 80 years in need of change. A unanimous vote is no longer possible. Why can't this be changed constitutionally? No doubt Alan will be talking more about the election of the next Secretary General, and that will come up, but very relevant point. If you want to write to us, our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Thanks to our acting executive producer, Kylie Gray, and producer, Jessie Kay. Hamish, Geraldine, and both of us will be back tomorrow for a special episode. See you tomorrow, Kylie.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.